Okay, everyone. Well, I thought we'd get this session underway. My name is Kyla, and I'm going to be chairing this session of Marxism 2011. And I'm very happy to introduce now Paul Adams, who is going to be speaking about Percy Brookfield and the Labour Volunteer Army. Paul Adams obviously wrote this fantastic book, which I can recommend to everyone. It's available in our bookstall, about Percy Brookfield. And so I'll let him take it away. There will be time at the end of Paul's introduction for people to raise questions and discussion and this sort of thing. So take it away, Paul.
After many years of being a university lecturer, I actually encourage people to yell out if you've got a question or an observation. Any response is good. I'm Paul Adams, and I was, as they say, born and bred in Broken Hill. Until recently, I taught media studies at the University of New England in Armdale. And I say until recently because I've accepted a package and I'm now officially between jobs, so, you know, is anything going, just let me know. As a young man, I can't even say as a young man, I became interested in politics very, very young. As a young man growing up in Broken Hill, I'd heard of Brookfield, but that was about it. I'd heard of other radical union leaders, like there was always this kind of mythology about Broken Hill and unionism, but I didn't have any details. Years later, I worked for the New South Wales Parliament as a committee officer in Legislative Assembly committees and joint committees, and a colleague published a little piece in what's called Assembly Lines, which is the in-house journal of the New South Wales Legislative Assembly. And so that kind of sparked my interest. However, nothing happened until my nana died. And what happened was, on my way through Broken Hill one time, I went out to the cemetery to visit my nana's grave. And on the way out, I noticed a prominent memorial. And it's sort of so prominent that here's my nana's grave here, or just out of view, and you see this little thing up here over there in the corner, and that's the Brookfield Memorial. I noticed it's near one of the main entrances as you go in. So on the way out, I stopped and had a look at it. And as you can see, it's a sort of unusual piece. It's actually got a lot of classical elements, but I did art history at Sydney Uni, and I can see that there are a few problems here. But nevertheless, it's very interesting, an unusual monument. Mostly because it's got all these socialist sort of inscriptions on it. One face, as you see here, has the opening of the red flag. And on the top is Workers of the World Unite. So you can see it's hardly your standard, you know, memorial. A colleague was planning a conference at UNE on death subjects objects. And I thought, well, this was an interesting piece. It's a kind of severely modernist, rationalist sort of interpretation of neoclassicism, which is what it is, was obviously designed to take Brookfield's place. Like, Brookfield's gone, and this is meant to carry on the role propagandizing to people. It stands there forever, well, until it falls over in the Broken Hill Cemetery, saying, "Workers of the World Unite." You know? It's taken its place. So I decided to write this paper about it, but then when I was doing research about the paper, I realized that unusual circumstances had thrown Brookfield up, but they'd also conspired, if you like, to have him forgotten. The thing is, he would never have been elected except for he was from Broken Hill, but then he was forgotten because he was from Broken Hill. It's like he, you know, the things which allowed him, this unusual character, to appear also allowed him to disappear. Everyone in Broken Hill knew about Brookfield, but he was largely forgotten outside union circles elsewhere. Now, there was a guy called Gilbert Roper who as a child saw the train carrying Brookfield's body leave Adelaide to go to Broken Hill, covered with flowers and whatnot. And Robert was moved as a child and spent his whole kind of career being moved by Brookfield. And he became a unionist. And when he died, he left two manuscripts unpublished, which are available out here as Labor's Titan. Now, obviously, the trouble with it is that he died before he could finish the book, and so it was edited from the manuscripts he left. Now, another character, this guy, Ern Wetherall, who was a mate of Brookfield's and then minister for this and that and the other in Sydney years later, the state parliament, he retired from politics and he set about writing a history of what he called the stormy years in Broken Hill, which is 1911 to 1921. He said, because Brookfield's story must be told. Now, then Wetherall dies, leaving his manuscript unpublished. So when I found this out, I thought, well, there's a story here that's, you know, waiting to be told. And with my kind of connections with Broken Hill and my sort of childhood interest in politics, my long-standing interest in politics, it really suited me perfectly as a project. And that's what I spent the next 5 years doing. And it probably led to my leaving UNE, in as much as I was supposed to be writing about media studies instead of writing a book on Percy Brookfield. Now, so like I say, I was, you know, from Broken Hill and I was interested in politics. It had a lot of meanings for me. But there are also public reasons why I sort of, which inspired me or helped to get me to write it. And one of them is to do with the Great War. Many people seem to believe that, you know, the Great War was, everyone in Australia was happy about the Great War and everyone supported it and, you know, we all went off and that was great. However, what a lot of people don't know is that during the Great War, it was a period of tremendous political turmoil and the country was hardly united. As a matter of fact, it was quite divided. And Brookfield was very much part of that. At the time, of course, during the First World War, a lot of people who opposed the war and opposed conscription were presented as cowards or as shirkers. And I think here's a nice Norman Lindsay image of a shirker. Now, the thing is, of course, that's not just peculiar to the First World War. Ever since, anyone who's opposed wars or has opposed popular, you know, government policies has tended to be presented as a shirker or a coward. You know, that's what led me to write about this guy. Brookfield was not a shirker, and despite what the popular press had to say about him, he definitely wasn't a coward. Brookfield rose to prominence in Broken Hill as a unionist and then the leader of an anti-conscription organisation. He was elected to the New South Wales Parliament, where he was one of the most radical elected representatives ever elected in this country. He became a national notoriety for his strident opposition to the war and his infamous statement that he would not shed one drop of blood for the Union Jack, saying instead that he would fight only under the red flag. He then became engraved in the national consciousness of one of the most vital opponents of conscription during the conscription debates. This is evident from the Anti's Creed, which was the most famous conscriptionist pamphlet of the 1917 referendum campaign. Now, this pamphlet was issued here in Melbourne and it was issued by the Victorian Reinforcements Council. So this is part of a national campaign. Now, if you look down here, you'll see that everything that they hated is listed here, really. And if you go down to this line here, you'll see that the anti-war or anti-conscription people they most hated are listed here. Now, it's interesting that you've got Contravine, Feely, Ryan, Blackburn, Brookfield, Mannix, and all their works, okay? So this is, you can see it's on the national stage because these are the most despised antis in the country. Now, Feely and Ryan were from Queensland. Ryan was the Premier of Queensland, and Feely was a minister in his cabinet. Mannix, of course, was the Catholic Archbishop in Melbourne for many years. And Blackburn here, I'm trying to find his full name. Morris McRae Blackburn, who was had been the member for Essendon and was a long time, you know, socialist. Now, so you've got two Queenslanders, two Victorians. Surprisingly, the other two are from Broken Hill. Considine was the MHR for Barrier, which effectively meant Broken Hill, so in the federal parliament, which of course was here in Melbourne at the time. And Brookfield is, you know, the man I'm talking about today, who at this time was the member for Sturt, which was South Broken Hill and some other parts of Broken Hill in the New South Wales State Parliament. So you can see that they're, well, at least despised by some. At the same time, now, later Brookfield went on to be active in the most sort of fraught events of politics in Australia over these next few years. He was heavily involved in and pivotal in getting the released many of these people here, who were the IWW 12 or the Sydney 12, who were charged with conspiring to burn down Sydney. Of course, the IWW is the Industrial Workers of the World. And like I say, Brookfield was pivotal in getting them the convictions quashed and many of them released and whatnot. And that was a major sort of event in Australia. He was also pivotal in Paul Freeman was deported. Paul Freeman effectively ended up being stateless. He was abducted from his camp in Queensland and put on a ship in Sydney to be sent to the United States. The ship broke down not far out of Sydney and had to return to Sydney. And then they repaired the ship and he went to San Francisco, where he denied being an American, so they sent him back. Then he was sent back again to San Francisco and the same thing happened. And then he went back to Sydney and ultimately there were riots and all manner of people got involved and Brookfield was once again pivotal in getting Freeman off the ship, which they did. But of course later on they just sent him, you know, on another ship to Hamburg. Anyway, and Brookfield was also pivotal in relation to Peter Simonov. Peter Simonov, I don't know if you know, was appointed by the Soviets as the Consul General. But of course he wasn't recognised by the Australian government. Simonov had, like Paul Freeman, had been a miner in Broken Hill. He knew Brookfield from Broken Hill. Brookfield bailed him and helped him through his court cases. Because what happened was Simonov was going around as if he was the Consul General. But the government was treating him like he was an aberrant citizen. So you can see that, and this is wartime, so you can see that Simonov's, you know, was in an invidious situation. Well, you know, Brookfield bailed him out, and he ended up sharing the Brookfield's place in Woolloomooloo in Sydney, and Brookfield was a politician. So when he was forming the Communist Party, he was actually sharing the house with Brookfield. And then Brookfield was also pivotal in the big strike. Now, by whatever measure, the big strike was one of the biggest industrial disputes in Australian history. The miners were out from May 1919 to November 1920, and in that time they lived largely on potatoes and jam and onions. It was said that by the end of the strike there wasn't a cat in Broken Hill. And the only reason that the strike was won in the end was Brookfield had been kicked out of the Labor Party and was in the New South Wales Parliament as the only member of the Industrial Labor Party. But Storey's ALP government held power by one vote. So Brookfield had the balance of power. So Brookfield used his balance of power, one, to get a new treatment for the IWW who were in jail, and two, to win the big strike. Because basically they put pressure on the guy who was arbitrating and, you know, Brookfield pressured the Premier, who pressured the judge, and then the judge came down in favour of the strikers and they won the strike and basically all through to Brookfield. And what they won was the first 35-hour week in Australia and a whole lot of other improved conditions. Now, a few months after the strike finished, Brookfield was on a train going back to Sydney from Broken Hill. People, to understand how remote Broken Hill was in those days from Sydney, which is the state capital, you have to realise that the way you went from Broken Hill to Sydney was you caught the train to Adelaide, and then a train to Melbourne, and then a train to Sydney, or you caught the train to Adelaide, and then you got a steamer from Adelaide around to Sydney. So going back to Sydney from Broken Hill, he was on the train going down to Adelaide, when a deranged Russian by the name of Kulman Tumail got off the train with his Beretta pistol and started shooting people. He shot 41 times and he shot four people before Brookfield intervened. And here he is after he was treated very roughly when they finally got him, as you can see. Brookfield ultimately confronted Tumail and he was shot in the abdomen, and they rushed him down to Adelaide, but he died in hospital that afternoon. Now, this meant that Brookfield died at the absolute peak of his popularity. Like, he had just had victory after victory, and he, without buckling and being under the red flag the whole way and ultimately winning the big strike, and then he's heroically or foolishly, however you want to think about it, shot and dies. So they put Brookfield's coffin on the train up to Broken Hill. Roper sees the train leaving, covered in flowers, his move for his whole life. And what follows is the greatest funeral ever held in Broken Hill. I'll read this bit. First came a rider carrying a red flag. Immediately behind came the band, members of Parliament, union officials and Labor representatives. Almost every organisation in Broken Hill was represented in the official representative in the official procession, which included thousands of unionists and members of women's groups. The columns of marching men and women were 8 to 15 wide. Then came 127 vehicles. The hearse was pulled by six black horses festooned with red ribbons, and ultimately, 15,000 of the town's 24,000 inhabitants went out to the cemetery. At the graveside, the band played and a chorus of thousands sang the red flag and then Should I Ever Be a Soldier. I'll put the lyrics up of these a bit later. Now, the remainder of my talk is really about how Brookfield became, if you like, one of the most hated and most loved men in Australia at the time. Now, I've given part of this paper previously at the New International Bookshop, and I took that opportunity, and I'll do it again now because it's got another nice Melbourne connection. And at the beginning of 1916, the Broken Hill miners struck for a 44-hour week. The strike is what first brought Brookfield to prominence in union circles. During the strike for the 44-hour week, Brookfield was elected chairman of the strike committee. Then, when there was an alleged case of victimisation, Brookfield travelled to Melbourne to be a witness in the arbitration court. As it happens, the company's representatives, was this man. Bailiou had his finger in a lot of pies, but he made most of his fortune out of Broken Hill. He owned several or large chunks of several mining companies in Broken Hill. So he was the main company representative at the time. However, I'm really mentioning, I just threw him in because of the obvious, you know, currency. Two trade union officials played very important roles in the strike. These were the President and Assistant Secretary of the Melbourne Trades Hall Council, Christopher Bennett and Laurie Cohen. When a temporary compromise was cooked up, the compromise, I think, is interesting, so I'll just mention it. They wanted a 44-hour week, which was a five-and-a-half-day week, right, instead of a six-day week. So that they wanted Saturday afternoons off, mainly so they could play football or go to the pub or whatever, you know. And the arbitration court wouldn't hear the case. So this one of the unionists from Broken Hill, J.J. O'Reilly, John Joseph O'Reilly, came up with the idea of, we'll work a four-day week. then you're not agreeing to our conditions and we're not agreeing to your conditions. You can make money because the price of ore was high and we don't have to, the unions don't have to pay the workers, and we can do that until the case is heard. So that's what they came up with. The miners in Broken Hill suspected a ruse and voted against it. They didn't think it had come from their own. They thought it had come from the other side. So Laurie Cohen was one of a group of politicians and unionists who travelled up to Broken Hill from Melbourne to persuade the miners to, you know, accept the deal, the temporary compromise. So what happens is Cohen goes up to Broken Hill, and then I'll read this bit out from the book. Returning to Melbourne after speaking to the strikers, Laurie Cohen caught the express to Adelaide. There he addressed a fundraising gathering for the Broken Hill miners and retired to his hotel room for the evening. Not long before 1 a.m, his lifeless body was found on the pavement 18 feet below his bedroom window. Cohen's death shocked many. Whether he fell, jumped or was pushed was never to be explained. The Broken Hill unionists who had worked with Cohen were devastated. Addressing the barrier unionists after the strike, I should point out Broken Hill's in the barrier ranges, and a lot of times barriers used just to mean Broken Hill. Our J.J. O'Reilly said that too much credit cannot be given to the late Laurie Cohen. At the same mass meeting, the president of the Broken Hill Miners Union, Mick Considine, concluded his report on the dispute by saying, "I wish to express my sincere regret at the untimely sad end of Laurie Cohen, to whom more than any other individual is due the successful ending of the Broken Hill strike." So that's how Brookfield first appears. He's chairman in the strike for the 44-hour week. Chairman of the strike committee. Now, this is the next bit. This is the next bit which really shoots him to prominence in Broken Hill and nationally. And that's, as I've got here, Percy Brookfield on Broken Hill's militant resistance of the 1916 conscription referendum, Labor's Volunteer Army. The war hit Broken Hill much harder than it did other places for the simple reason. Like, we talk about globalisation now, but the ore from Broken Hill mainly went to Germany or Belgium, like back before the First World War. And Germany was actually the centre of the metalliferous trade, global metalliferous trade. All the zinc from Broken Hill went to either Germany or Belgium. So when the war breaks out, obviously, you know, all bets are off because you're sending armaments effectively to the other side. So immediately all the mines closed and most people were thrown out of work. Nevertheless, just to show you a couple of the mines. Nevertheless, when the war broke out, it was enthusiastically welcomed in Broken Hill. You can see here the central mine does its bit, sends off 5 horses. The call for enlistments was, you know, like more than subscribed several times over, and most people supported the war. However, right from the start, actually, here we go, wartime parade in Argent Street in Broken Hill. However, right from the start, there were some major opponents to the war in Broken Hill. And, of course, virtually all these were members. Brookfield wasn't. He never joined any organisation apart from sort of labour, kind of working men's kind of club sort of things. These next couple were members of the Australian Socialist Party branch in Broken Hill. And this is Michael Patrick Considine, who I've already mentioned as one of the most despised antis, because he's the union president, and then he goes on to be the MHR for Broken Hill. And he was a strident opponent. There were both Australian Socialist Party, there was an Australian Socialist Party in Broken Hill, and there was an IWW in Broken Hill. There were rival left-wing organisations at the time. Broken Hill was at the time like the sort of centre of radicalism in Australia, even though it's kind of like now quite a sort of insignificant sort of place. And another key organiser that's also been mentioned is J.J. O'Reilly, and they were both in the ASP. And they're both important members of the union, especially at the time Considine, who was president of the union. Now, in 1916, Broken Hill was a heavily unionised mining city, and the AMA, the Amalgamated Miners Association, was its most powerful union. It had about 5,000 members. In the middle, or six at times, In the middle of the year, the AMA started to organise to resist conscription because the rumours going around that there's going to be conscription. Now, one of the reasons why they opposed conscription was they thought that military conscription would be followed by industrial conscription. In other words, if you weren't sent off to war, you would be made to work under conditions which were like equivalent of being in the military. You'd lose your right to strike and all these sorts of things. So, and I should also say that there's a connection with Melbourne here in as much as several of the key unions travelled down to Melbourne during the strike for the 44-hour week at the beginning of 1916. And in Melbourne at the time, you had quite a few people organising against the war on conscription. And in particular, you had a group called the Women's Peace Army. And the Women's Peace Army was probably one of the inspirations for what was formed in Broken Hill in the middle of the year. So in July 1916, Broken Hill's militant anti-conscription organisation was formed at a meeting in the Trades Hall. Labor's volunteer army, or voluntary army for home defence, was not a pacifist organisation. The members of Labor's voluntary army, or the LVA as it was known, were eligibles who publicly refused conscription. The LVA's inaugural meeting was a vitriolic recruitment drive. The meeting's militant tone is obvious in the Barrier Daily Truth report. The Barrier Daily Truth was a miners' union paper. Its four headings were Labor's Volunteer Army, Freedom's Fight of 1916, Organisation of Barrier Eligibles, and the Fiery Cross to the Working Class. Considine announced that the AMA was starting an army of eligibles opposed to this conscription of life and labour. Forming an army, he explained, would be a serious and difficult affair, but it was their purpose to collect the shock troops who would have to bear the full brunt of conscription. Like, I've cut this speech down, but if you see the whole speech, he's just whipping the crowd into a frenzy. The crowd was warned to expect a life and death struggle between the workers and those who would fasten the shackles of conscription upon them. Constantine whipped the crowd into a near frenzy and applause followed his claim that, in a quote, it might mean a long term of imprisonment or even standing before firing squads, but whatever it was, those who enlisted in Labor's army would be expected to see the thing through. You can see it mirrors the frenzied conscription rallies of the war. You know, it's exactly like what it's sort of opposing. Pausing the crusade to only raise it again, Constantine said that he was not trying to coerce people, but it was only if the authorities saw they preferred even the grave to conscription, they could frustrate the attempts to make them tools of the master class. "We may be making history here tonight," said Constantine, and after declaring that he and O'Reilly would travel to Melbourne to form other army divisions, he expressed confidence that the workers around Australia would fall into line behind the barrier workers. Now, the meeting culminated with the reading of the pledge. You'll see that this is definitely not a case of pacifism. Don't name me my imprisonment or death. And I take the pledge voluntarily and freely, and only if I break it, I would brand a traitor to my class. Anyway, now reportedly the pledge was adopted unanimously, but it's very hard to see someone ringing out at this point going, "Oh, I'm not sure," you know. Maybe not. Anyway, then more than 500 people enlisted at the end of this rally, right, inside the Trades Hall. Brookfield was elected president of Labor's Volunteer Army. Brookfield was known as Jack in Broken Hill, or even more commonly as Brookie. He was a native of Wavertree, which was then just outside Liverpool in the UK. He went to sea as a 13-year-old, so he was a boy sailor working on sailing ships, mainly doing the South American trade. And he did that until he landed in Australia in 1894 when he was discharged at the Port of Melbourne. Now, the reason he was discharged at the Port of Melbourne was because in 1893 there was an enormous depression in Australia, probably had a greater impact than the Great Depression, and it was centred in Melbourne. And and of course, it was based on a housing bubble, a real estate bubble. Anyway, for many years, Brookfield carried his swag up and down the East Coast. He worked as a miner. He drove horses, the usual things. He prospected. He arrived in Broken Hill in 1911 and was working on the BHP mine later that year. He was all but unnoticed till 1916 when he became a union organiser in the strike for the 44-hour week. The role he played in that strike was what led to him being elected to, president of the LVA. In keeping with the militant tone of the LVA, he was often referred to as General Brookfield. Now, the inaugural meeting that elected Brookfield also elected a guy called Edward Sinclair as its secretary, and then they formed a choir to sing songs and teach them to the multitude. And this was their anthem here. Joe Hill's song, Should I Ever Be a Soldier? And, we're spending billions every year for guns and ammunition, our army and our navy gear to keep in good condition. While millions live in misery and millions died before us. Now, if you carry on, this, to me, as much as anything, sums up Brookfield's view on things. This was his anthem. This is the song he liked the most. And as I mentioned previously, it was sung at his funeral. Okay. And this is out of this book, Labor's Volunteer Army Songbook, which was published by the LVA in Broken Hill. And the following year in 1917, it was one of the 200 publications prohibited by the federal government under the War Precautions Act. Now, the next week after their original meeting, they had another 5,000 people attend the LVA demonstration, and then hundreds more enlisted. So you're getting this enormous sort of movement. It's forming very, very rapidly. At this meeting, Brookfield and Ennis talked. Brookfield had a great solidarity with the British, of course being one himself, but especially the British working class, and his primary loyalty was to his class. At a later rally, Brookfield said, show you where the next meeting was, inside there, the Trades Hall in Broken Hill. At a later rally, Brookfield said, England had got conscription hard and fast, and the result there had been starvation, misery, long hours, and a lot of balderdash about freedom. The prosperity of England had been based upon the existence of starving millions of people. Now, the following week, there were a couple of LVA-related events in Melbourne. One of these was a complete non-event. Asked his opinion on the formation in Broken Hill of the LVA, the Minister for Defence, Senator Pearce, declined to comment. On the Yarra Bank that day, Considine and O'Reilly addressed great crowds on the LVA. The two Broken Hill unionists reportedly received a splendid hearing there and then again that night at the Guild Hall, which I believe is RMIT down there. The BDT in Broken Hill, the Barry Daly Truth in Broken Hill report confidently concludes a brigade is to be formed in Melbourne. Considine and O'Reilly did not temper their positions in Melbourne. As industrialists said, Considine, we believe in fighting conscription to the death. Right. The formation of the LVA was a major event in Broken Hill. The spectacle of groups of men marching, wearing red scarlet ribbons and marching around singing If I Were a Soldier must have aggravated conscriptionists. Clearly it was too much for some and the battle was about to become violent. In 1916, Argent Street was a busy thoroughfare dotted with pubs and other entertainments. The LVA executive decided to propagate its message to these passing crowds. On Friday evening, the 4th of August, nine committee men took their table to the Grand Hotel corner and scores of people gathered around. Brookfield climbed onto the table, but before he could speak, before he could speak, a voice cried out, "If you are going to allow this, you are a lot of British cowards." Then others shouted, "You cold-footed plank, come under the ground and we will deal with you, you big coward of a blank, and you have no manhood in you." The LVA president replied, "We are fighting for a cause. We are fighting for a principle." Brookfield managed a couple more responses before being pelted with eggs and tomatoes. Then, to the cry of "kill, kill," the mob surged forward, the table was smashed, papers were scattered around, and scuffles broke out. The attack centred on Brookfield. I don't know how big he was. There are various reports. I mean, you know, like a lot of this is unreliable. He might have been 6'3", but he was clearly a big bloke. He was a big and powerful man, and he knocked several of the attackers to the ground. Then someone managed to hit Brookfield in the small of the back with a brick. After this, Brookfield was overcome and kicked while he was down. During the scuffle, one patriot managed to stab Brookfield in the mouth with an umbrella. Bleeding, Brookfield was assisted off to a chemist's shop. As the assault proceeded, the police looked on, this is Wetherill's description, "If they were not actually enjoying the assault, then at least they were able to maintain a wonderful calmness. However, after it became clear that he was getting the better of a parson who had attacked him, Sinclair, the secretary of the LVA, was arrested. He was arrested, you know, just when he was getting the better of the parson. He was escorted to the police station and the crowd followed. Then someone yelled, "Raid the IWW. The 1,000-strong mob and police raced up Argent Street to the IWW Hall. The chemist where Brookfield was getting treated was on the way, so the crowd raced past the chemist where Brookfield was getting treated for his cuts and whatnot. So Brookfield races out, pushes his way through the crowd to the front of the IWW building that they're attacking, and then beside the police fights with the people who are trying to ransack the IWW building. Then when the action was all but over, the police arrested Brookfield. The ruckus had produced only two arrests, and they happened to be the president and secretary of the LVA. The following morning, Sinclair and Brookfield appeared before Stipendiary Magistrate Giles Shaw. Now, Giles Shaw is in the Barrier Empire League, like the Broken Hill Pro Conscription League, and he's, you know, like hearing the case. Shaw was, Sinclair was fined £1 for riotous behaviour. Shaw said, the magistrate said that it was acceptable for an assaulted man to strike one blow in return, but Sinclair had no right to avenge himself and he appeared to have gone beyond reasonable self-defence. Brookfield was similarly charged. Brookfield conducted his own offence based on the evidence of the police. Inspector Miller testified that the accused was doing his best to keep the crowd back. He was not the aggressor. He tried to assist the police in keeping the crowd back from the IWW Hall at great risk. Stipendiary Magistrate Shaw thanked Brookfield for helping the police. Brookfield later said that Shaw thanked him so much he thought he was going to give him a fiver out of the poor box. However, Shaw ruled this: "Brookfield, you were struck and apparently you were not the aggressor, but you foolishly struck back, which may have caused serious riots. Still, you have my sympathy and there is no necessity of a fine. I will bind you over to be of good behaviour for 12 months in the sum of £5. So he's been bound over for assisting the police. Anyway, Brookfield was absolutely incensed. Actually, I should have been showing you this one during that. These were souvenirs. What happened after Brookfield's funeral, they made, this is why there are so many pictures of it, they made the pictures of the funeral into souvenirs, which they sold, and that's how they paid for the memorial. And you can see that this is one of the souvenirs. So Brookfield's, incensed. He and Wetherill swing into action. After his court appearance, the two of them went to enlist the support of the IWW. They met with Peter Larkin, whose brother James was a famous Irish rebel. Wetherill described Larkin as the local IWW's high priest. The IWW men were persuaded that it was necessary to retake the lost trench in the cause of freedom of speech, and a military-style meeting was held that night. The previous night, it would have been hard to tell who was what, And so what they did was they, 200 members of the IWW and the LVA, put white handkerchiefs around their necks and positioned themselves around the platform and in concentric rings. So, you know, and they also agreed that if anyone was arrested, they would just let them go, but they'd carry on the meeting regardless. So they'd organised. So there they are. Reportedly, George Dale said that 10,000 people turned up. I mean, you've got to say that George Dale's 10,000 slipped a little bit too readily off the tongue or off the pen, you know. But anyway, it was obviously a very, very big crowd. Now, as they're preparing to do their talk, a police sergeant, and there's police nearby, as the previous night, the police sergeant said, "What is this, Mr. Brookfield?" Brookfield replied, "We are here to hold a meeting, Sergeant, and if what was done last night is attempted tonight, we will win. They gave us no quarter last night, they will get none tonight." It was obvious right from the start that the tables were turned. When Mark Anthony, it's true, introduced the speaker, Peter Larkin, there was thunderous applause followed by profound silence. As it happens, two people raise their voices. One of them was basically thumped and was assisted off by the police. And the other one, who went to say something, the police said to him, "Can't you see? You know, the situation is different." The meeting closed with three cheers for Considine, Larkin, Brookfield and Sinclair for freedom of speech and the LVA. Then there's a whole round of sort of different meetings where the AMA and the LVA and the IWW affirm their support for each other. And in one of these, Brookfield said he was not an advocate of violence, but he was not going to allow any man or combination of men to molest him. And from this point on, the LVA had several gatherings every week, including monster rallies on Sunday afternoons. You've got to appreciate that this is the campaign. There's now a campaign underway for conscription, and so this is the campaign against conscription. Now, the next step. In August, the Barrier Returned Soldiers Association passed a resolution threatening to take the strongest measures if the LVA's taking possession of the streets and parks of the city did not cease immediately. However, nothing came of this threat. And similarly, the Barrier Empire League, the main pro-conscription organisation, requested the federal government to instruct the proper authorities to at once put a stop to anti-recruiting and anti-conscription and disloyal meetings, speeches and publications in Broken Hill. Now, nothing seemed to come from these requests, except for a couple of weeks later, a sensor was installed at the Barrier Daily Truth. And you can see here, the censorship didn't last very long. Well, he was there for the duration of the war, but the game didn't last very long, because what they did was anything censored, they did that. So you could see what was censored, of course, and then the censor wouldn't allow them to do that, you know, because it showed the censorship. So there's very little evidence of the censorship, but okay. Now, things carry on through September until there's a court case, the next sort of action. Brookfield, Sinclair and Edward McLaughlin, who was an IWW delegate to the LVA, all faced charges relating to their anti-conscription activities. Brookfield was charged in relation to a speech he made in front of the Trades Hall. There he said, "We have to fight the curse of conscription that Billy Hughes, whom we have placed in power, is trying to place on us. Good God Almighty, men, don't you realise what will happen if we allow conscription to be foisted on us? If it is better to die in Argent Street than in the trenches, then by Christ, do it. You're asked to sing God Save the King. Why don't he do a bit of praying himself? Why isn't he asked to get down his knees and pray for you? Why should Billy Hughes, the traitor, have the power to force conscription on us? The thing, the animal, the miserable little skunk. He's a traitor and a viper." So that's what Brookfield's charged with. Sinclair was accused of having said, "It is better to be a traitor to your king than a traitor to your class." And McLaughlin was charged with having sung Christians at War, an IWW parody of Onward Christian Soldiers. which is fairly full on. God above is calling you to rape and, you know, rob and rape and kill. You know, I think sort of seals it. Brookfield, Sinclair and McLaughlin were fined £5 and bound over to be a good behaviour for 1 year. As the cases sprung from the anti-conscription statements, the defendants objected to it being heard by the prominent member of the Barrier Empire League, Charles Shaw. He was the same judge. Shaw dismissed their objections, saying that his private opinions were not relevant to his official position. While Brookfield, Sinclair and McLaughlin were inside, a 1,000-strong crowd gathered outside the court. Now, as it happens, there's a picture here. It's not of this event, but it's of a similar one later, once a different court case involving Brookfield. But you can see the crowds out the front of the court and blocking the tram, a similar kind of scene. During the court proceedings, the people outside sang Labour songs and cheered Brookfield's every move as he used the opportunity to repeat his character assassinations of Hughes while questioning Inspector Miller, who had laid the charges. So, yeah, you can imagine it went along the lines of, so I called him a thing, you know. Did I call Billy Hughes a skunk? You know, did I say he was a traitor and a viper? You know, something like that. Anyway, during the court proceedings, the people out, and so what followed, writes George Dale, must go down into history as one of the most disgraceful and brutal acts known to any Australian force. Exasperated, feeling threatened or annoyed by Brookfield's mockery inside the court and the crowd lapping it up outside, Inspector Miller ordered a baton charge. The sudden and unexpected assault produced chaos. People scattered in all directions and some, including an older woman, fell into a putrid rubbish hole behind the police station. The initial action was followed by a frantic toing and throwing in which charges were made, people repeatedly fled and regathered, stones were thrown from the back of the crowd, and then women were used as human shields by baton-wielding police. Then, Dale writes, the cowardly rascals were called off by a superior officer. The brutal episode animated the LVA. Each time there's one of these incidents, it actually just reinvigorates them. You know, they just get bigger and stronger and more determined. When it seemed the poll was going to be close, the LVA adopted the less belligerent title of the Anti-Conscription Party. The change was entirely one of public image, and the office holders, including Brookfield and Sinclair, remained the same. In the final month, the campaign reached a fever pitch. Rallies were held daily in the streets and parks of Broken Hill by the Anti-Conscription Party, i.e. the LVA, the AMA, that's the Miners' Union, the IWW, the Barrier Labor Federation, and the Political Labor League, which was what the Labor Party was then known as New South Wales. The campaign culminated on a referendum eve, where they did this march from the Trades Hall. So they marched from the Trades Hall to the place where the assault had taken place here. But they do it, you know, in this manner rather than directly. And once again, Dale says 10,000 people. Who knows, obviously a good crowd, marched to the spot where the organisers had been assaulted. At the end of the campaign, the LVA had over 2,000 eligibles enlisted. And it's reported that only one of these, you know, to use Dale's words again, proved himself to be sufficient traitor to break the solemn pledge that he had made to his mates when he joined the LVA. Australia-wide, 72,000 voted against the referendum. Led by Brookfield's righteous fervour, the anti-conscription campaign carried a large proportion of Broken Hill's population. There were 3,858 votes for yes and 8,922 votes for no. And that's the end of the talk.